People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. In the memoir, Crackdown, Garth Mullins tells stories about heroin use, incarceration, dope sickness, overdose, and drug user activism. Mullins hosts a podcast, also called Crackdown, about drugs, drug policy, and the war on drugs. He's coming to Nanaimo to share some of his experiences on Tuesday, April 7th at the Harborfront Library. The author talk is being put on in part by the Nanaimo Area Network of Drug Users, or NANDU. Anne Livingston is involved with the group. She also helped found the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users back in the 1990s. She visited the CHLY studio to speak with me about Garth Mullins' upcoming Nanaimo talk.
My name's Anne Livingston. I'm 71. I've been organizing drug users for 30 years and in the downtown east side, but after the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users seemed to be stable and happening and not on the verge of being obliterated, I went to Surrey, Abbotsford, Chilliwack, Nanaimo. I'm not sure where else. Anyway, to organize drug user groups. And I been commuting to Nanaimo to organize a group called the Nanaimo Area Network of Drug Users, probably for 5 years.
And the Nanaimo Area Network of Drug Users are having Garth Mullins come to give an author talk about his book, Crackdown, Surviving and Resisting the War on Drugs. Before we get to that, what kind of background would you want people to have about what NANDU is, what a drug user group is and does?
Yeah, a drug user group, just in the simplest mission statement, is to improve the lives of people who have not been successful at stopping using drugs through user-to-user advocacy, education, and support. And we do it with a weekly meeting. And it's we're a registered nonprofit society, so we follow the Societies Act and have an annual general meeting where the board of directors is.
And so what does that look like? What happens at those meetings here in Nanaimo generally?
Well, various topics come off the floor, and I try to bring whatever I think is, you know, relevant. So sometimes we look at, there's an international network of people who use drugs. Who knew? Well, most people, you know, that are using drugs in Nanaimo wouldn't know that. And you know what I mean? A little bit of the history, and that they're part of a social justice movement, as well as needing individual advocacy when they're mistreated by hospitals, police, bylaw. You know, they need, because I think there's been a very, very long tradition of, no matter what a person who uses drugs says, they're not believed. And they need extra advocacy. And I could go on and on. They need an ombudsperson. We need an actual legal advocate who will follow up. Because when you have a vulnerable population like this, terrible things happen to them, because people who are predators know that no one will ever believe what they're saying. So one of our goals, though, is to get the public educated to advocate for safer drug policies where we're not going to see these huge numbers of death, to keep up education where what are the experts saying? What is the best practice? What do actual studies show, rather than what your neighbor who has a brother-in-law who quit when he was in jail, therefore jail's the best thing for getting, you know, you get a lot of, it's completely ridden with myths. I think of all topics, I don't know if this goes on with diabetics, people can sit in a bar and chat to each other, and the opinion of somebody who knows absolutely nothing about drugs, addiction, toxic drugs, incarceration, bylaws, they will have an opinion. And for some reason, that is just as strong as somebody who has a PhD and has studied addiction and for many years.
And now you're bringing Garth Mullins to give a talk on April 7th. Can you tell me what went into that? What is going to be discussed? Why Garth Mullins?
Well, it's a first opportunity. I think we've tried a few times. We meet at the Vancouver Regional Vancouver Island Regional Library at the Nanaimo branch downtown. And it's been a real negotiation with them and tremendous patience, both with the library and us, to just say there's no other public space to meet. And I think that it's starting to feel more like a partnership where we respond to any complaints they have, and we continue to try and build that relationship where it hasn't been possible with other groups. So, you know, libraries were set up because people that were too poor to buy books could have a place to get books. So in their kind of grounding philosophy, it's an actual good match to just say everyone's a citizen, everyone has a right to go to a library, you know, and of course you're going to get kicked out if you screw up the rules. So we're very clear about that. But anyway, the partnership with the library is very exciting. And the other group is Mom Stop the Harm. So between the three of us, we've had, I've been trying to do this for a year. It's embarrassing how long it's taking. But, you know, things just finally came out to be the right time to do it. And it's the first time we've tried it. Garth is, his book is so good. And, you know, he also does a podcast, Crackdown. So it was the first time we had him agree to do it. And I'm going, it's a book, you know, libraries, books, you know. So I wasn't sure if we could just do it with other guest speakers, but we hope to be able to do more of them. And we want a wider discussion. If you just have people who are involved in, you know, harm reduction, talking to other people involved in harm reduction, it's not going to work out. His book is so intriguing and interesting as a story to tell. And I recommend people get a hold of it. Ironically, the library doesn't have a copy. And I think there's an audio version of it available, or it's available on Kindle. You know what I mean? People should really get it. It's not a quick read, but it pulls you along. It's extremely easy to read, and it's very, very well written. And I think his book allows for a wider discussion of issues that we all face. We've got children. You know, do we, you know, have white knuckling it through our kids? They might drink a beer when they grow up, and God, they could become an alcoholic. And yet we have this incredibly misinformed understanding of other substances, whether, you know, what's addictive, what isn't, what's prescribed, what isn't. There needs to be a much broader discussion. But the real alarm is that people are blaming drug users for a poison drug supply. And the drug supply is absolutely poisoned. And, you know, an old timer like me remembers nostalgically when heroin was heroin and cocaine was, well, the cocaine was actually good back then. And I still think cocaine doesn't have a lot of adulterants in it, unless you have a sloppy dealer and they end up putting it on a scale and the fentanyl's been on. So you do get poisonings of people who are using stimulants, and they're terrible, tragic deaths. But all of us face, if we've got a young person that we're raising, they could end up with one dose of something once and they're dead. And that's why Mom Stop the Harm is so important, is that they bring a voice to this discussion that is, you know, the average mom. And then other mothers who say, you know, their family was very troubled. The kid got involved in drugs early. They've been on the street for 10 years. They can die, but your kid could die and has never been on the street and just ended up with some poison at a party. So that has to be opened up. And that's the real danger of the toxic drug supply, and why we need to have, you know, prescribed drugs or some way of getting drugs to people. I personally like the Buyers Club model. And you know what I mean? The Drug User Liberation Front's doing a terrific job of publicizing that. But they've also allowed now in Switzerland, where marijuana is still illegal, a marijuana buyers club. And then they moved on to a cocaine buyers club. So I keep searching to see, because I think there'll be a paper published on it, how it went and stuff. But anyway, back to this, the discussion needs to be a wide discussion. And people who are interested in social justice, people who are interested in drug use itself, people who are interested in autobiographies and writing. There's a wider group of people to come and listen to what Garth has to say and have a look at his excellent book.
The book is really a memoir of Garth Mullen's experiences. It kind of goes through his childhood. He has been an injection drug user. It talks about, for example, the first time that he used heroin. It talks about some of his encounters with the law, a time he spent a couple of weeks in prison in the United States. It talked about some what clinically you would call adverse childhood experiences that he went through, and some of the difficulty he had, you know, vocalizing that and trying to seek help at the time. What have you taken away from checking out so far the book?
Well, I love the way that he tells his story. And then at any, so my understanding is, I mean, I heard him interviewed once and he said, well, you know, I was writing this book and my friend said, you know, it's good and it's interesting, but it's not you. So I think that the step back was like when he spends time in London, he takes the time to give you the history of heroin prescription in London and the kind of, you know, because this is a very rich topic. And his depiction of jail is very, very realistic. People who think it's good, they'll learn a lesson if they go to jail. I'm like, oh my God, please don't let your kids go to jail, whatever you can do. And then his efforts at 12-step, a lot of the bizarre barriers that were put in place for the methadone program. And we fought a lot of those. A lot of the advances in methadone policy is directly as a result of Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users having a phone number at the College of Physicians and Surgeons for the Methadone Committee. So you will never find that phone number again. And we even picketed the College of Physicians and Surgeons briefly one day and got media coverage of it. And that's the pressure it takes for them to make the changes that they did make. And HIV/AIDS hit the neighborhood. So we just said, you know, and we had, you know, at various times you have people in government or bureaucrats working in government who really want to be proud that they've accomplished something and brought these deaths down or something. So that's been a really interesting relationship. And the other accomplishment of the BC Association of People on Methadone, who Garth was involved with and a leader in that, and they've taken on the College of Physicians and Surgeons, they've taken on the government and won a lawsuit because the government was taking money off of their food money and sending it to private clinics. And they won over, I don't know how many million dollar settlement. And everybody who had that money stolen was paid back. And the people who had died in the meantime, which is plenty of people, that went into the Laura Shaver Fund, which is held. And you can make applications to start a opiate agonist therapy, or group for people who are on OAT, which opiate agonist therapy. So it's methadone and any of the list. Now, safe supply has been cut back and is all observed. So that, you know, we're going to have more tragedy and more, oh God, help us. You know, the distortion of how many people use drugs in this province, which is 225,000 just in BC. Of those, 125,000 use every single day. And what you'd be wired or have some kind of substance use disorder. The other 100,000 are buying MDA at a party, you know, or any time they're using any illicit drug, they're counted as people who are vulnerable to toxic drug poisoning because they're buying from this rotten, horrible mess of a market where, you know, every other day there's some new horrible addictive and debilitating poison. Usually veterinary medications are added to the drugs.
You're listening to People First Radio. Anne Livingston has spent decades helping drug users organize. She was a founding member of the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users back in the 1990s, and more recently has been involved with the Nanaimo Area Network of Drug Users, or NANDU for short. They're hosting author Garth Mullins for a talk at the Vancouver Island Regional Library's Nanaimo Harborfront Branch Tuesday, April 7th. Mullins will be speaking about his memoir, Crackdown. It chronicles his experiences as a heroin user and his activism around drug policy. Earlier in our conversation, Livingston mentioned the library doesn't have a copy of Mullins' book. They do, however, have a digital copy of both the written and audiobooks. When you're having an event like this, how do you, maybe I'll say, build bridges or create connections as so that, you know, people who use drugs or people who provide services to people who use drugs or people who are curious about what this whole scene is like or people who are just community members who would like to see some of the issues they associate with drug use go away? How do you get it so that those people can kind of connect and share?
Well, I hope they'll come. I mean, this is, I'm so old. I remember when most churches had social justice committees, and that was how, when we were forming the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users in the late 90s and that kind of thing, we made the was Bud Osborne was a poet. And Garth has the same ability with this book to be able to break through and have people admire his actual writing, his accomplishments, and his thorough knowledge of everything to do with addictions. So, you know, the descriptions of trying to do 12-step work, trying to go to rehab, like it's all in here. And it's very rare that we hear in a comprehensive way all of the barriers that people are facing. So, and there's people who, I hope people in recovery will come. I hope people that are curious will come. I hope people who hate drug users will come. And, you know, because how would I put this? When you know, we need the community to have a hearing. It's nothing wrong with coming to an event like this. And then during the question period, ask the questions that you think were, you know, just smoothing over. Yeah, free drugs for drug users. If only, you know, I guess we sure as hell wouldn't have all these deaths if they actually got real drugs rather than this toxic supply. So all of these, you know, quick quips, and I think it's important. And I think people should feel safe to come and listen and, you know, listen. The moms will have their literature there. The Moms Stop the Harm. I think these are really the way it's done in terms of having in-person dialogues. In public settings where people are invited to come and have a discussion about what do you think. If you think methadone's terrible, then say what you think would be better. Or if you think treatment's great, you know, explain how we're going to pay $1,500 a day per person, per day, every day, for them to be in treatment. And then when we let them go, they go live in a tent. We've got some stuff going on that needs to be really, like, clearly understood. It treatment isn't pixie dust you sprinkle on somebody and then they're good. People relapse all the time, and it shouldn't be a thing. You should be going, great, you got in, you know, 6 weeks or 6 months, or you got in a year. That'll never be taken from you. Now that you're using again, we want you to stay alive. And if you want to go back and try it again, it shouldn't be viewed as such a failure that you'll never go back or that you're barred from that place. We have tremendous difficulty with people being barred from treatment, and they're also barred from housing permanently. You know, one housing, you know, these and shelters, and this can't go on. This is why you need this kind of advocacy of a movement of people who are going to just go the extra mile. It was advocates who got shelters. It was advocates who got treatment. It was AA was formed by people who did not want the medical treatment that was offered to alcoholics at the time. Because you were to live in a sanatorium and be declared morally, whatever, moral torpitude or something. You're hopeless. You would never. That's what they did. That was the treatment. And some people got together and formed AA saying, we're not good with this and we're going to figure this out on our own. And they did. And it wasn't funded and stuff. I mean, there's all kinds of problems now that it's court ordered and all this crap. They should never allow that stuff in there. But the idea of a group of people that are despised, criminalized, and hated, which you were if you were an alcoholic, you came out of that criminal alcohol prohibition period, you were a criminal and you were defective and incurable. That was it. That was the end of the line. So the idea that a group of people that are treated this badly and hated this much get together and want to create changes and want to create a, you know, tip the system over and say, we want to say in how this is run and we want our humanity recognized and that our strengths are looked at and that, you know, what can we do if no one else will help us. And that's the situation that the drug user groups are in now. We received some funding for a few years, and it was so minuscule that you really, you know what I mean? It's beyond comprehension. I think that each drug user group got less money than, I don't know, probably 20,000 people in the healthcare system are pulling in more than 120,000 a year just in their personal wages. And that's what we'd get for a whole year. And we'd have 400, 500 members, you know, and you're trying to pay rent out of that. You know, as our groups are disfunded, I hope what we can prove is that we can carry on without funding. And there's ways to do that, like using a library. This library doesn't charge rent. The Surrey Library charges like $120 to rent their big room per session. I mean, we were like, okay. But you know what I mean? You're dealing with then civil groups, you know, community associations, business associations. These are the people that we want to have these dialogues with so that they really come away knowing more and feeling less frustrated. Funding more and more police is not working. They've done it now. Who hasn't gotten an increase in their police funding? Tell me a community somewhere, because I don't know of any. You know, that's what we got to realize. What are the limitations of this, and how can we really have a problem-solving approach rather than, well, we're never funding user groups. We philosophically disagree. We think they're encouraging drug use, as if you could do that. I mean, I suppose you could push drugs on people who are homeless, have no hope for the future, and have so much trauma from their childhoods. Yeah, I bet they will take drugs if you push it on them, the same way they'll take alcohol if you push it on them. But I think that if you've ever tried to get someone to stop using drugs, you'll realize that you have no power over that. It's not in that realm. It's a whole different beast. And I think it needs to be understood that there's no magic, what they'd call treatment. And it's not even available. Endless discussions about involuntary treatment. And people keep saying there's no voluntary treatment. I mean, I follow it along a little bit, but I always think, how in 30 years of experience that I have is that I could actually have someone walk up to me and say, I want to go to treatment today, and I will have not a clue where to take them. I would go, I think, how is this possible that I am this experienced with this much expertise, and yet locally in almost any part of this province. I'd go to the rack at St. Paul's. I'd start there, but I'd keep a sharp eye on them. And I think you have to go between 9 and 4 Monday to Friday. So don't show up on the weekend. You know what I mean? You got to have a lot of insight and knowledge to understand many, many systems that are available.
This is People First Radio. I'm speaking with drug user group organizer Anne Livingston. We're chatting about an upcoming author talk at Nanaimo's Harborfront Library. Crackdown podcast host Garth Mullins is going to be speaking about his memoir, which is also called Crackdown. It deals with his life experiences as a heroin user and his experiences going on methadone and advocating for drug policy changes. You address this a little bit there, but maybe very explicitly from like a first principles kind of place. What would you say to people about how a drug user group like NANDU, to the extent that, you know, one group that's made up of various people can have a view or a stance, how would you suggest a drug user group might view the idea of drug use? How would you present that to people who are kind of completely outside the world of drug use when they hear there's a drug user group and they think, well, but wait, aren't drugs causing all this harm and really illegal? How does a group like NANDU think about drug use?
Well, you know, it's hard to say a group and a think, but I mean, I think what happens is there's this sense of real caring in communities and a real bond. It's like the moms stop the harm. There's a group you don't ever want to belong to, the moms with the dead kids. Like, no one's lining up to join that group, I can tell you. But once they do, they have a tremendous sense of caring and support for one another and insight, and then a kind of a rage that this happens on their watch. We've had 10 years of a public health emergency declared legally within our laws. And it gives the government inordinate power to take action. And yet every single tiny little thing that's opposed by a municipality or anything to trip anything up on your way to doing what the most learned experts in this province, and we have some of the, Vancouver was the first place, I don't know if it was North America, whether New York City or Vancouver got methadone first, I don't know. But these are tremendously knowledgeable drug treatment. Pioneering has gone in BC for many, many years. It's just that the government, when we go to put something in place like decrim, they don't bother to educate the public about it. And so we ended up with just this kind of a police backlash that was extremely well organized and international. Did you know that Australia has two safe injection sites and they're fighting because one of them's going to get shut down? Ontario is shutting down eight of them. This is all politics. And Bud Osborne used to say that, and I'm sure Garth would agree, people aren't really dying of drugs. They're dying of politics. It's so insane to, you know, if you envision recriminalizing alcohol or criminalizing tobacco, you'd get tremendous harm because it would all start to be taken over by the black market. And we'd get, people don't seem to have that insight. And that's some of the stuff I think that needs to be understood. So that's one of the goals of the group. And then they want to, I think the thing they just love to do is something where they physically get to do something that's helpful. So our user group puts up a tent for the welfare week because, I don't know, they got 30 years of data showing that the death rates during welfare week are higher. So it's to reassure people. They can sit at the tent because the overdose prevention site in Nanaimo closes at 9 o'clock, last calls at 8:30. And people use drugs after 9 o'clock at night when the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, and there's a few other drug user groups there, that put the pressure on Insight to say, you've got to open longer hours on welfare. They did it. I don't think they had a big discussion and had to go back to the funder. They just did it and then went to the funder. All we get now is, no, well, you know, we're only licensed. Like, they just start saying, well, the rules are. And they're ignoring the fact that they've got a real problem on welfare week and they should open till midnight or something. You know what I mean? Figure something out. Have a group of drug users that are advising them. And also that if the Center for Disease Control in British Columbia is going to go all this trouble of keeping the most detailed statistics I've ever seen in my life, you can look up a village in this province and find out what the overdose, how many people have been found dead there. I mean, not too small because they won't give you those, but, you know, Nanaimo's numbers and Campbell Rivers. And we have an inordinately high number of people who died. It's a disproportionate. We're a death zone in Nanaimo. And I think it's because of homelessness, but it's also because of a kind of palatable hostility, which usually translates into self-hatred for drug users. So that's one of the big things about joining a group is now you're a member of something. You've never been invited to be a member of anything. The usual line was come back when you got 2 years clean, then it was come back, whatever. You just are not viewed as capable. And in this group, you join, you get to make decisions. You get to, if you want to take a leadership role, you get to run for the board of directors. And you slug it out. We have weekly board of director meetings because we don't have, because it's that responsive, the danger to people in the community. You don't want to find out a month later that something's gone wrong. You might as well find out next week and then just keep on it so we can make adjustments and stuff as we go along. The other thing is, I think it's important. I mean, I think it helps. I don't think people do well in recovery if they hate themselves and think they should die. I'm just saying. And that really happens to people who use drugs. The media, the constant slurring and hatred and people throwing things at them on the street. It's not easy to keep your self-esteem together. And I think the drug user group allows for a certain kind of pride that we know what the AIDS rate is in this town or the overdose rate. It's HIV is not so much of a concern because people aren't injecting anymore. They're smoking their drugs. But, you know, just to be able to be well-informed and also know that in other countries and in other places in the world, drug user groups are valued. And, you know, despite this backlash, which is going on all over the world.
What does a successful author talk from Garth Mullins in Nanaimo look like to you?
Well, it's our first one. So we're going to have snack and we're going to have coffee and tea. And I don't know. I think the drug users are going to come, but we're hoping that I don't know, people who are concerned. We hope city councilors will come. I would hope business improvement associations, people that are politicians, you know, they should just come and listen. If they're not, then just bring the average Joe. I mean, if you hate drug users, come. If you love drug users, come. Let's have this real discussion. And because I think, you know, here's the other thing that's so weird. We can make these super long lists of people who we only discover use opiates and were addicted when they're found dead. People that are admired and held in such esteem. And that's such a contradiction to me that, I don't know, that people can get that much social status and be so admired and then die of an overdose. Like, what's that revealing, really? I mean, in terms of whether they're flawed or weak or, you know, only good junkie's a dead junkie, you know, that kind of thing where, I don't know. It's an interesting topic to me in terms of how wide the discussion can range, I guess.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today on this?
Yeah, it starts at 3:30, and it's a weird time to do it. It's a Tuesday afternoon, 3:30, and we had to do that because there's no more helijets after 5:45, and I need to get them back to Vancouver. But anyway, that's our first attempt. If people contact the library, like, we're hoping that we can get a bunch of these going on. And I can't remember if before COVID there were book talks at the libraries. I think there were. There were more in-person community meetings. So we're hoping that this is a post-COVID come to an in-person event and, you know, have a snack, make friends, ask questions.
Well, Anne Livingston, thank you very much for coming down to the CHLY studio to chat about it with me.
You're welcome.
Drug user group organizer Anne Livingston speaking about an upcoming author talk in Nanaimo. The event will see Crackdown podcast host Garth Mullins speak about his memoir, also called Crackdown. It's Tuesday, April 7th at the Vancouver Island Regional Library's Nanaimo Harborfront Branch.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
A nurse and UVic PhD student is working to bring more understanding to the intersection between chronic pain and sexual health. Janice Finley lives with chronic pain and has also worked as a nurse in sexual health clinics. She says the places people can go in the healthcare system for help with chronic pain tend not to be well equipped to help with concerns related to sexuality. Meanwhile, sexual health clinics tend to be focused on things like STIs, harm reduction, and contraception, and not necessarily sexuality concerns related to chronic pain. Finley is planning to speak with people of reproductive age with chronic pain to better understand their experience of sexuality. I reached her in Calgary to talk about her research.
I'm Janice Finley. I'm a registered nurse and advanced practice nurse. I'm currently doing my PhD through the University of Victoria. Most of my work involves sexual health. So right now, my research is around chronic pain and sexuality, and I've worked as a sexual health nurse since 2014, and I did my undergraduate degree at VIU, Vancouver Island University. So I'm currently located in Calgary, but have strong ties to the island.
And what has got you looking at chronic pain and intimacy in this PhD?
Mm-hmm. I actually always knew that I wanted to research or be involved in sexual health somehow. Like, I knew in my undergrad at VIU that I was just really excited about sexual health for some reason. It just got me excited and sparked. And I was like, this is something that people don't talk about. And it's really important. And so any project I could do in my undergraduate degree, I would choose something related to sexual health. So it kind of started there. And then I became a sexual health nurse. And then in the last, I would say, so I did my master's degree from 2020 to 2022. And that's where I kind of shifted my focus to chronic pain as well, because I live with chronic pain. And that's been something that I've had since I was about 13. So since 2006.
And can you walk me through what exactly are you, what's a question you're trying to answer?
Yeah, my research, so my methodology, sorry for the big word, is a narrative inquiry. So I'm really looking at understanding people's stories and experiences. And what I want to understand is how chronic pain affects sexuality and identity in people that live with chronic pain. I'm looking at people of reproductive age that are accessing sexual reproductive health care. And then I'm also trying to understand how their partners, their intimate partners, sexual partners, romantic partners, whatever you want to call them, how they experience being with someone that lives with chronic pain or a disability, and then also their experiences accessing health care.
And you're coming at this kind of with a dual background of having worked a bit in the healthcare field and also the background of having been in the healthcare field, having spent a long time without getting an accurate diagnosis. Could you talk to me about maybe the intersection of those two parts of your story and how they kind of interact with this work?
Yeah, I do think I have a unique perspective in my work because I have lived experience of chronic pain and disability. And then I'm also a nurse and have worked with people that have chronic pain, disability in sexual health spaces. So I do find that that's quite a unique perspective. For me, like what I noticed when I was working in sexual health, I started initially in mostly women's health clinics. And I found that women would come to me and share stories with me about their disabilities or chronic pain. And they would say, hey, I've never had anyone tell you that before. Like, I've never told anyone that before. Thank you for making this a safe space. And I was like, oh, okay, there's something going on here where like the chronic pain piece, the disability piece isn't being addressed in sexual health clinics. And then at the same time in chronic pain clinics, the sexuality piece isn't very well addressed either. So there's kind of like, I describe it as, my research interests are kind of like two buckets. We've got the sexual health bit and then we have the disability bit. And when you look at the healthcare system, neither are really working together. So it's like, where would you go? Because you can go to a sexual health clinic and be like, yeah, I have this disability or this chronic pain. And unfortunately, sexual health clinics, they're great, don't get me wrong, are very much focused on harm reduction, STIs, avoiding pregnancy, but not necessarily sexuality. And then the chronic pain clinics, which are a little bit more focused on identity and your well-being and who you are as a person and how you're living with all of it, aren't super well equipped to address the sexuality piece. So it's like, where do you go if you're someone that has chronic pain and issues with sexuality? Yeah, that's kind of where I came from. Yeah.
Could you give me a sense of what are some of the things a person might be seeking support for from the medical system? And what are some of the kind of things that the medical system could and maybe right now is not doing for folks?
Mm-hmm. I can speak to maybe more of an Alberta perspective, but I'm a student in BC, so I know a little bit. I would say it's really looking at the whole person. I'm finding things are very compartmentalized. And in my personal experience living with a disability, I see a lot of different specialists, but there isn't a lot of coordination between all of them in terms of like, this is a person, this is her identity, these are the things we need to know. It's more like, hey, you have this issue, we'll deal with this. And then you see someone else and it's like, okay, there's this issue, we'll deal with this. So it's very compartmentalized. I would love to see chronic pain clinics address sexuality better. I think that would be a good strategy in terms of like It's kind of like what we see in the literature a lot of the time. And also, if you look at the research around pain centers and healthcare, sexuality and sex is kind of put to the side. It's kind of like, well, you don't need that to survive, so we're not going to address it. So it's very much a survival kind of strategy where it's like, okay, we can deal with your pain, but then you want to talk about sex. I don't know. People don't know how to talk about it. They don't, because we don't. We just don't.
That makes a lot of sense. And you're talking about, I imagine, just generally people don't know how to talk about sex. You mentioned that off the top, like forgetting the chronic pain piece.
A lot of the time I don't even, I've shifted now, but years ago, I wouldn't even tell people what I actually did for work. I would say, yeah, I work in public health instead of sexual health because it's so stigmatized.
Could you talk to me a little bit about like what that stigma looks like and what that means, what the consequences are?
I would say it makes people uncomfortable to talk about sex. And now I'm at a point in my career where I'm like, I'm going to make people talk about sex because it doesn't make me uncomfortable. And this is very important because like sexuality is part of being human, whether you choose to have sex or not, it doesn't matter, but it's still part of being human and it's part of identity, but it's this one piece of our lives that somehow is just taboo to talk about still, which surprises me. But again, I've been working in sexual health for a very long time. So I can visibly see that people get uncomfortable when I bring up sex. So I do it on purpose because I'm like, well, we need to fix this in society.
Now, you're doing this research, you're looking for people's narrative stories around chronic pain and intimacy. Do you have like a hypothesis here? Are there things you're expecting to hear from folks?
So I'm coming to this research with what I think I will learn and what my findings will be, but I'm also don't want to go into it with a bias that this is what I know from my previous research and reading literature and hearing other people's stories. And so therefore it's going to be X, Y, Z. And the methodology that I use is fairly broad. So I go in with kind of a hypothesis, but at the same time, it's very much like fluid and I'm focused on what's important to my participants in the research. So, and actually one thing that I thought I would have is primarily female participants, but I actually have had male participants as well, which is a really interesting perspective. So what I'm expecting to see is kind of what we've talked about already a little bit in terms of like people aren't really sure where to go to talk about their issues around sex because it's not seen as something that's essential to health, even though the World Health Organization does recognize it as essential to being human, basically. Like it's considered a basic need if you decide to engage in sex. But it's kind of the thing that gets left out, I find, a lot of the time when you look at the theory around social determinants of health, social dimensions of health. Yeah. So I don't have a hypothesis. I have what we call a research puzzle, which is, I'm not going to get too theoretical here, but my research methodology starts broad and then you shape the research based on what your participants tell you is important to them. But essentially, I am wanting to know, how does chronic pain, generalized chronic pain, affect identity around sexuality?
And once you have all of those conversations and you go away and you compile it, what happens to the research and the information that you've collected? How does it impact and make a change in the world?
Yeah. So for me, it's really important for any research I do to be very accessible to the people that might have an interest in it. So healthcare providers, people that live with chronic pain, of course, researchers and academics as well. So, I mean, the typical route is I'll write my PhD thesis, get a PhD, become Dr. Janice Finlay, all the things, and publish some papers. But more importantly, what I want to do is write different papers or articles that are really accessible to people that want to read it. And then I also plan to make a document, like a very short documentary film, using paid actors to kind of voice some of what the participants are saying and what's important that I think people in the public, people that live with chronic pain, and people that work in healthcare need to know.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest is nurse and UVic PhD student Janice Finley. We're talking about her research exploring how people experience and navigate chronic pain, disability, and sexuality. So really, is it a fair takeaway that a big thing coming out of this is you're going to talk to a lot of people? We might have a vague sense right now that, like, hey, there are some issues around chronic pain and intimacy. Maybe there's not a good place to go to, or maybe there's not a lot of support out there. But we don't really know exactly what people are going to say. The goal of the research is to talk to people who are experiencing chronic pain, hear how it impacts their identity and how they move through the world. And then you can identify some concerns there. You can share them with people who maybe are in the world of healthcare and then work to address them from there.
Yeah, that's a great summary. I will also be working hopefully with like a patient advisory committee and with other healthcare providers to come up with some recommendations around, okay, if you see somebody in the clinic that says, I have this diagnosis that is related to chronic pain, maybe there's an algorithm, like what are some of the educational things that you need to address? But I would say this is an under-researched area and healthcare providers want to help, but they don't necessarily know how or have the capacity or the time to work with patients that have chronic pain with sexual health issues. A lot of what we see in the research and literature is if someone has chronic pain and then you're also looking at sex and sexuality, it's very much focused on either people that have specifically pain with sex, like sexual health disorders, or it's focused on like male functioning, but not necessarily the overarching issue of you live with generalized chronic pain, you have this disability. And then a lot of what I talk about, I won't get too theoretical, is like the disability hierarchy, where like we're kind of like, okay, so a lot of the research is around, if we're looking at sex and pain, it's around people that have cancer. It's around erectile dysfunction. And then also specifically pain with sex. So like more localized issues, but not so much identity and relationships and intimacy.
Can you explain what that means, identity, relationships, intimacy in this context?
Absolutely. So one resource I really like is called the Sexuality Wheel, and that was developed by Teaching Sexual Health in Alberta. And when you look at what sexuality means, and so here's one thing that I come across, I'll back up a little bit, is when I talk about sex and sexuality, people think they mean the same thing, but sex is more the physical act, and then sexuality is the identity piece. So like, who are you in your sexuality? Is it important to you to engage in sex, to have intimacy, all of those things? Who do you want to have sex with? How much sex do you want to have? See, these are things we don't talk about in society because it's still taboo. But one resource I really like is the Sexuality Wheel. And so when you look at identity, what influences somebody's sexuality are not just your sexual orientation, although that's one piece, but also what are your values? What's important to you in a relationship? What's your personality? What's your gender identity? What's your gender expression? How do you communicate? What's your, again, sexual orientation? What's your self-image? What have your previous experiences been? And so all of those things influence somebody's identity around sexuality. So one thing we see a lot with chronic pain and disability is kind of that body image and self-image piece.
Could you walk me through what advice you might give someone on how to navigate various concerns they may have around chronic pain and intimacy in the healthcare system as it is right now? And obviously, I imagine this is going to depend on like, what is the concern?
Yeah, I would say be open as possible about it. Like, be bold. Don't be afraid to express your concerns. Because what I see in my nursing practice is people are very shy and afraid to say, hey, this is an issue that I'm experiencing. What do I do about it? The more we talk about it, the more patients or healthcare providers talk about it, the more we can get comfortable talking about these things. And then being like, wait, there's a resource that's missing. Or the nurse might go, hey, I'm not sure how to address this. So let me go learn about it so I can do better next time with somebody.
When you say talk about it, is there a specific like avenue you would recommend someone go through? You talked about the idea that there, you know, there are chronic pain places out there, specialists out there, there are sexual health clinics out there, you know, maybe there's like your family doctor or the walk-in clinic's GP. What do you think about even who to go to with concerns?
Yeah, that's a gap that I've noticed so far, because like I mentioned earlier, chronic pain clinics, that would be ideal if somebody's accessing a program through a chronic pain center. But what we find is, especially for younger people or males, there isn't really resources for people around sex and sexuality. It's kind of like, oh, you have a disability, you have chronic pain, we just assume you don't have sex, which is not the case. Or it's very focused on, like I mentioned, localized pain with sex. And then again, the gap with sexual health clinics is that they're very harm reduction focused, which is great, but doesn't necessarily address the sexuality identity piece. So I would say start with a family doctor or maybe a sexual health clinic, and they can probably refer you depending on your issue, because maybe a pelvic health physiotherapist is what somebody would need, or maybe they need a sex therapist. So I would say, yeah, start with like a family doctor or a sexual health clinic or the chronic pain clinics, and they can probably refer from there.
Are you still actively recruiting people to take part in your research and share their stories?
I am. However, I'm Calgary-based right now, so I'm open to virtual participation, but preferring in-person right now. I'm hoping that when I finish my PhD research, I'll be able to do bigger studies and I can really engage more with this kind of work and recruit BC, Alberta, have a lot more to do. Yeah.
Well, how does someone sign up?
Yeah, they can email me. So either through my website, like you contacted me, Joe, or my email, which is, I guess we're on the radio. So JaniceFinlay@uvic.ca. But if you look up my name, you can find my website and also contact me there.
And when are you expecting to wrap this all up?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully my PhD doesn't go on for forever, because graduate school is difficult. I think every PhD student is like, I just want this to be over, even though I love what I'm doing. So I'm hoping that all the data collection will happen over the next 6 months. And then I'll continue to write my thesis, and then be finished my PhD in about a year. Yeah.
So this research is around chronic pain and intimacy. You've talked off the hop and throughout our conversation about how it's just difficult. There's a bit of a taboo still really around talking about sex. When it comes to the chronic pain piece, we've kind of just used the word chronic pain a lot. Is there anything you think people need to know specifically about like what that means? What are some of the various ways that can look? What do you think is important people understand when they hear us talking about chronic pain?
So 1 in 5 Canadians live with chronic pain. That's the statistic that we know. I think a lot of people live with chronic pain and don't realize it, or maybe don't accept it. So the way I describe it to my nursing students around my research is we have two topics that are stigmatized. We have sex and sexuality, and then we have chronic pain and disability. When you put them together, that's like extra stigmatized, because nobody wants to be disabled or accept that that's a thing. But chronic pain can be really disabling, and it looks different in everybody. So that would be kind of my message, is a lot of people live with chronic pain and mask it, and you might not know that it's affecting them, but it's actually a lot more common than I think we recognize in Canada. Yeah.
So people who work in the healthcare system, presumably your research is going to be super relevant to them. People who are experiencing chronic pain, your research obviously going to be super relevant to them. What would you say to people who aren't in either of those two groups right now about what they should know about this issue, how they should kind of move through the world differently as a consequence of having an awareness of that?
I would say be curious. What we know from my work and research and the literature is that people that live with chronic pain and disabilities are very frequently dismissed. And so I think understand that it can fluctuate. So there's different types of disabilities, right? But sometimes an invisible disability is the most, like, the most dismissed type, because it's like one day you can look like you're doing okay, and then the next day the person is in a pain flare up and can't even function. So be curious, be understanding, be compassionate. And I think being curious is the most important thing when you're trying to learn something, like learn about a group that you don't know anything about.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation on this today?
Yeah, I want people to be talking about sex. Like, just talk about it.
How do you do that?
It takes time. I have to remember I've been working in this field for over 10 years. And so it's very easy for me, and I get a rise out of intentionally asking my doctors and my healthcare providers with my disability about things, because I just want to see their reaction and see how they handle it. So get comfortable talking about it. You just start somewhere, however you can, and it gets easier. And then you're like, oh, this isn't such a big deal to talk about. It's not actually, it doesn't need to be stigmatized.
Well, Janice Finley, thank you very much for talking to me about it today.
Yes, thanks for the opportunity.
Janice Finley is a PhD student at the University of Victoria, researching how people experience and navigate chronic pain, disability, and sexuality. That's all the time we have for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.